I'm Kim, and welcome to EsoTorque's podcast, You Can't Eat the Sunshine, for the month of April 2017. Join us as we talk with preservationist Steve Luffman about his efforts to save Kurt Meyer's Litton Savings, a mid-century landmark threatened with demolition because it sits on the land where Frank Gehry hopes to build a huge mixed-use development. We'll also visit with filmmaker Douglas Quill to learn about his last-ditch campaign to preserve Frank Sinatra's motion picture bungalow on the old Goldwyn Studios lot in Hollywood, so stay tuned.
You can't eat the sunshine, but you can make a beeline for the best of the coastline. La 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 la. Skid Row, Solano Canyon, the Doria, and Pico Union, a long-lost neighborhood called Hermina between South Pass and Highland Park, Grand Central Park. It is divine. You can't eat the sunshine, but it's a gold mine.
Welcome, everyone. Thank you for listening to our podcast for the month of April 2017. It is You Can't Eat the Sunshine. We have two guests this month, as always. First guest, Steve Luffman. He's a preservationist. We're going to talk to him about his efforts to save the Litton Savings at the corner of Crescent Heights and Sunset. That's a Kurt Meyer building, and he has been just amazing. He's the guy that he wrote the HCM, the Historic Cultural Monument application for it. So we're going to get a snapshot, a weather report, and look back, look ahead, and I'm looking forward to coming back in a year. Second interview, filmmaker Doug Quill. Doug Quill has an office on the lot. The lot is formerly the United Artists, formerly the Samuel Goldwyn Studios, Formosa in Santa Monica. About 5 years ago, the site of a fair amount of preservation squabble because of the renovations Sim Group did then. It is again in the crosshairs. The Frank Sinatra bungalow and some sound stages in back or in peril. Doug is going to bring us up to speed, and we have some good updates to precede the interview. Okay, so let's jump in. Okay, Kim, you are the Pishka maven.
I am, and that means this is the part of the podcast where I tell you, no, we don't have annoying ads from MailChimp or any of those other people. Ooh, I said an advertiser. No, we just occasionally remind you if you like what we do and you'd like to be supportive, we do have a tip jar, and we would always be so grateful for your contributions of any size to help support our work traveling around Southern California looking for interesting people to talk to for you to listen to. Never obligatory, always appreciated. Thanks for your support.
Great, Kim. Thank you so much. So let's jump in. There's so much backstory to both these interviews that I want to keep the closely watched train section on the short side, okay? Because So we have two watched trains. Let's jump in to the first one, Kim. As I was setting up the recording equipment for this podcast, you sent me a URL about plans for a redesign yet again of LACMA.
Yeah, kind of an interesting surprise. The Los Angeles County Museum of Art, which has been proposed to be largely demolished, the historic William Pereira campus from 1965, to be replaced by a large oozing blob by Peter Zumthor, the Swiss architect, like Kurt Meyer, also a Swiss architect who worked in Los Angeles. This blob pattern, not really the most popular design that was ever put forward, and also not really an incredibly well-thought-out design. It's been very hard to understand what this building is meant to be, aside from the fact that it clearly is meant to obliterate the Pereira campus and to span Wilshire, which is a scenic byway. And that's a huge preservation and conservation crisis in and of itself. But, you know, there's been a lot of pushback against this idea of coming in with this oozing blob-like pattern. And interestingly enough, they've gone back to the drawing board, and there's a new design that's just been put forward, and Zumthor now seems to have actually, you know, put some interns on the project, made some effort, come up with a design, which is supposed to evoke an Incan temple, which does have some interesting Southern California influence to it, if you talk about some of the oddball 1920s and 30s Southern California designs that did rely on Incan and Mayan temples.
So Zumthor is not aware of any of this, Kim.
Oh, come on. He must be.
No.
Well, I don't know. But in any case, now instead of a big black blob that looks a little like the tar pits that, by the way, the initial plan would have endangered, it's now this big hulking mausoleum that sort of cantilevers out over a story of glass, which I guess is possible with engineering. The claim is that it's actually meant to evoke the stone walls of the May Company building to the west, but interestingly, it kind of has a bit of the look of maybe the William Pereira building expanded outward and made more Instagrammable. But again, the plan still holds that they want to span Wilshire and put one spindly little foot on this incredibly valuable piece of land that the supervisors control that belongs to the County of Los Angeles, which could be a high rise and an incredible source of income for the museum in the future. So I think it's not just a preservation problem of not trying to conserve and preserve these very important 1965 buildings, which, although they've been terribly remodeled over the years, really have a lot of charm and class and style and speak to what is important about the development of Southern California. But beyond that, I mean, it's just financially so irresponsible to waste what could potentially be a very, very remunerative redevelopment site that is not, at the moment, part of the museum campus. So there's a lot to think about. I know that this is an important project for the museum's director, Michael Govan, but are they going to come up with all of the money to actually do this? I don't know. Maybe it's all just a bit of spitballing and an opportunity to hang out with fancy architects and have big conferences where everybody comes and there's no time for questions from the audience. I hate that.
There's an opening at the Metropolitan. Govan will take it.
Be a good place to go. There's a lot of good work to do in New York. Please leave Los Angeles landmarks alone. We kind of love them out here, despite our reputation.
Okay, Kim, thank you. Good. So let's, this is sort of a closely watched train. It's our 10th anniversary. And I know that our last closely watched train, there's a lot of raw energy around, so I don't want to forget our 10th anniversary. I know we have a bunch of events that we're going to talk about in a minute that are part of that, but just give us a 50,000-foot overview of our 10th anniversary.
Well, it's not our 10th anniversary as Kim and Richard. It's our 10th anniversary as Esoteric, and we did decide that it would be fun to do some special events this year, some tours that are not normally on the calendar.
And almost die in the process.
That's true. It's a lot of work to write a tour that's only going to happen once, but I'm very pleased that these tours have been filling up. We had our Symbionese Liberation Army tour in February, which was a blast with Brad Schreiber.
We're going to do that tour again.
We may do that tour again. It was great. It was very popular. We've got I guess by the time this podcast comes out, our Palos Verdes Ancient and Modern Tour will have just happened, and I'm pretty...
That's a blueprint.
I'm pretty sure that tour will be sold out by the time it rolls, and other 10th anniversary tours coming up. If you would like to be part of one of these all-day bus adventures in June, we're going to be going out to the Antelope Valley for the Desert Visionaries Tour, and there's some really special locations on that one, and it's... You know, Richard, I do enjoy these special event tours, but I have to say what I enjoy even more is going out and doing all the research with you and just having adventures in the Southern California wilderness and seeing lots of wildflowers, which has been a nice side effect of doing this research during this incredible post-rain springtime. I love it.
I love you too, darling. Okay, good. So thank you for the overview of the 10th anniversary. I think that moving forward into our second decade, people will see the architecture of some all-day tours that came out of the work, the heavy lifting we're doing right now. So Kim, our last closely watched train is Parker Center, and we just had a little squabble about the loading speed of the video, embedded video on the Lava page. So I'm going to let you take the lead on this because I really fret about the loading speed, and I actually have a solution to it, and it's something I worry about a lot. So it just...
Will you stop torturing our listeners with talk of loading speed? It's so freaking hard to be a preservationist. I mean, Richard and I look at each other and we say, preservation is pain, ha ha ha. But it is, because...
No, we don't say that. We say that to other people. When we're just ourselves, we just move forward.
Right, because we're doing this work and it's important. But you have experiences like we had at the end of March, where we'd had this planned Lava Sunday Salon where a bunch of people were coming together to talk about Parker Center, the police administration building that Walton Beckett designed with J.E. Stanton in 1955. Incredibly important building, an incredibly important modernist building, constructed by one of the iconic L.A. architects. You know, I mean, if you had a Capitol Records in your backyard, would you knock it down? Probably not. But at the same time, it's also just this machine for modern policing. It is a fascinating building in terms of what it meant to be the police force in one of the most advanced cities in terms of forensic science and surveillance in the 1950s, and what that meant for the city that would be. This building tells so many stories. And we were pretty sure that although it was technically endangered, it was going to be all right, because the Cultural Heritage Commission had come out so strongly for its preservation, speaking very frankly about the controversies, the fact that Chief Parker, for whom it was subsequently named, is a controversial figure. There are people who feel that he was not a good police chief because he reflected some of the racist ideas of his time. The fact that the people in the little Tokyo community cashed out, sold their property, sold part of Little Tokyo to the city of Los Angeles, didn't lose out in the deal necessarily, but may not have wished to do so. And it did happen. And, you know, a clear cutting was done of the land so that Parker Center and other structures could be built. You know, despite the fact that there are these iconic images of 1992 Rodney King rioters throwing trash cans at the doors of Parker Center as these glass doors buckle but do not give and police officers pull the doors shut behind them, you know, it is definitely a charged space. But the Cultural Heritage Commission weighed all of this against its merit as a building, and they determined that it did deserve to be a landmark. This is the recommendation that they made to the city council. And, you know, this is their job. These are very smart, accomplished people who understand the subtleties of what it means to judge a building on its merits and the many issues that are brought up by a building with almost, you know, 70 years of history. Richard?
So we are disappointed. What's important for people that
well,
care
what are we disappointed about? I haven't gotten to that yet.
what I'm trying to say is, you know, in January we had a meeting with Adrian Scott Fine and Alan Hess on a completely unrelated topic, like the first week of January, and we scheduled this March Lava Salon end of March, and we knew that that the building wasn't a done deal, saved, but what I do want to convey, because we are now are talking about it, I do want to convey, in January, no one at that table thought that there would be a full council vote, 12-0, to demolish the building the 2 days before the salon. I think we really thought there would be a six-month timeline, and that's what we did scheduled it in March to really get keep the dialogue up.
Absolutely, and I feel, you know, I feel bad, but at the same time, what can you do? I mean, you have, as I said, the Cultural Heritage Commission weighs the building, determines that it is worthy of being landmarked. And then Gail Kinnard, from one of the commissioners, actually writes an op-ed in the LA Times and explains their reasoning and says, you know, there are reasons to question why this building should be a landmark, but here's why it is a landmark. And all of the things that you're thinking make it not a landmark are actually reasons to preserve it, to not whitewash these negative aspects of Los Angeles history. And more power to her. And this goes to City Council, and Jose Huizar on the Plum Committee comes out and puts forward a motion to demolish the building and says, experts say this is not one of Welton's Beckett's best buildings, which is simply disingenuous and false. I mean, if you just want to clear a slate so that you can redevelop all of that part of the Civic Center with residential and hotel and retail, say it. Don't defame the quality of a building and don't dismiss the hard work that the Cultural Heritage Commission has done. And further, don't ignore the independent report of the Los Angeles Conservancy, which says, you know, at the time we planned this event, the Conservancy was saying it would cost $50 million more to demolish the building as opposed to adaptively reusing it. They have rerun their numbers, and now they say it's $100 million more. You know, this matters. These are tax dollars. This is a city landmark. This is a commission of professionals who are being ignored. At the end of the day, what's the rush? Why is it so important to knock down Parker Center? And what are we going to do as citizens if this is the way it goes? I mean, are commissions completely irrelevant? Why do people show up at commission hearings if their recommendations are going to be ignored? It's troubling. Historic preservation as public policy is a really positive thing. I mean, look what happened around Angels Flight Railway. The mayor, Mayor Garcetti, got involved in a private entity, helped to save Angels Flight, and actually appeared before the election. All of the reporters were so happy to see him because he hadn't been talking to anyone. And he came out specifically to talk about preservation as public policy and took some questions about Trump and other issues at the time. This is the right way to do things. Saving landmarks is the right way to run a city. That's just the way it is.
But I also, because you have to move through time-space to move into the future. You have to literally physically go through space, not just let time pass and sit here. So because you have to go through these experiences, I would just like to mention that it is an interesting side effect that the Cultural Heritage Commission, which every meeting I've gone to, they have been really very tough on people coming before them on projects they don't like, and berate them for waiting too long and
wasting their time.
And I get no small solace from watching City Council, the full City Council, treat the Cultural Heritage Commission the way the Cultural Heritage Commission treats many people that come before them. So what goes around comes around, and this is just where we are in this cycle.
And simply to wrap it up, then right after this vote, a proposal is put forward by the councilman, Koretz, to save this funky little nothing of a burger stand down off Pico. I love funky little nothings of a burger stands, but when you're voting to demolish mid-century landmarks and you're saving little anonymous burger stands with altered signage, where are your priorities?
Okay, so we're not done, but we have to stop. Okay. So we are not done with Parker Center in any way, shape, or form. What we are done with is the workflow that the Cultural Heritage Commission presents. What we are done with is the workflow with planning and land use management presents. And what we are now beginning is where we, as activists, with a really good working knowledge of how policy is made, can move forward. Okay? That's where we're ending this.
Can I add one little thing?
Yeah, you can add anything you want, John.
Well, I mean, there's just one little problem. I mean, you can vote to demolish Parker Center as they did, but there is artwork in Parker Center that is going to be very expensive and very time consuming to remove, and that is part of this entire proposal. So here we stand with a big question mark: who's going to move the Joseph Young mosaics? How are they going to do it? Where is it going to go? Who's going to pay for it? And how long is it going to take? Now we have questions, and we'll be keeping a close eye on that. It's a fabulous mosaic, and you can't wait to see it. And if you go to Parker Center and you get real close to the glass, you can kind of see it at an oblique angle, and I recommend it. It's full of L.A. landmarks, including Angels Flight Railway.
Thank you, Kim. I was just writing a note down about the Joseph Young stuff, which I don't want to forget. No. As you were talking, I remembered something about a workflow for that. Okay, good. So we're gonna move on. I want to get to the interviews, but before we get to the interviews, we have to go through some upcoming events, some upcoming lava events. The lava site will be have much better load speeds at the second half of this year. Kim, let's. I've got a crime lab coming up.
We do, and it's so close to being full. I encourage you to get your ticket quick or get on the waiting list. That's going to be
That'll make Brad happy.
Brad will be happy, yeah.
A lot of books.
He did that SLA tour with us, and he didn't bring enough books. This time he's going to know to bring enough books. Brad Schreiber presenting on his history of the coroner's office on April the 23rd, and also Professor Donald Johnson, who is always our host at these forensic science seminar fundraisers for the Criminalistics Graduate Department at Cal State Los Angeles, will be presenting sort of an introduction to crime scene investigation. And he is such a colorful, charming, delightful figure. Everybody always looks forward to Dr. Johnson presenting. So that's April the 23rd. Sunday, April the 30th even, is our next Lava Sunday Salon. And this one's going to be a nice preservationist public policy presentation in that we're going to be working with folks from the county who are currently conserving and restoring the Fort Moore Pioneer Memorial, which overlooks Chinatown, is on historic Fort Moore, one of the earlier sort of wartime reliquary spaces of early Los Angeles. And it's a really great mid-century fountain and wall piece that has sadly been allowed to decay over the decades. But now that there's a large retail and residential development going up just next to it, the county is investing the resources to really bring it up to its best. And we're going to be able to hear about the history of not just the landmark, but the hill itself, which has had many, many iterations, including sort of a mini Bunker Hill residential period during the Victorian era. And then we'll actually walk to the site and learn about this restoration project. And it's going to be a lot of fun. You don't even have to wear a hard hat. So that's free with RSVP. And I guess it'll be listed soon, if not now, at the end of May, our Lava Sunday Salon. You're going to list it?
By the time this is published, yes.
Okay. Well, our May Lava Sunday Salon is all about Charles Bukowski, featuring his friend and fellow poet, S.A. Griffin. And S.A. is going to give us a great presentation on knowing Bukowski and being influenced by him and sort of being an artist of similar stature. And then we're going to go, I know, because we always walk after we talk. We're going to go to Terminal Annex, the post office, the postal sorting facility where Bukowski was tortured, and talk about his life in that space. And it's a wonderful building. I don't know how much inside we'll be able to get on a Sunday, but we'll certainly be able to admire it. And I hope you can join us for that. As always, the Lava Sunday Salons are free with RSVP. We start in Grand Central Market at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on the last Sunday of the month. And then we go out
in the basement.
In the lower level, darling. And then we go out into downtown L.A., walking distance, and explore. And it's always just so much fun, and we would love to see you there.
And what do we do after the walking tour? What do we do we now start going and getting something to drink?
Yeah, I'm not sure where we'll go next time, but that was fun.
Felipe's.
Oh, we'll go to Felipe's, sure. We'll go across the street to Felipe's and get some, I think the coffee's 10 cents now.
Okay.
Get some 10-cent coffee.
And we can read the poem Bukowski wrote about Felipe's, too.
Mm-hmm. And if you eat 4 pickled eggs, I'll give you a prize.
Okay, good. Okay, Kim, I think we're ready to jump into this. So... Steve is my first interview, so I'll introduce him second. Doug is the second interview, so we introduce him now. Okay. Have I forgotten something, darling?
I think Doug goes by Douglas.
Douglas. Right, sorry, Douglas. Douglas Quill. Douglas Quill is a filmmaker. He's 28 years old. He has an office on the lot. That's where his production company is, and he is every day been staring at the Sinatra bungalow and these sound stages on the lot, which are slated for demolition imminently. Now, Kim, I want you to agree to what we're about to do because we did this interview the night before the commission hearing. Okay, and the interview is great, and it's all just getting us up to speed with this looming question. What will the commission say? Of course, I, of course, know what the commission was going to say.
Do you want to do it at the end?
No, I want you just to tell them.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, just let's just put it on the table.
All right, well, we'll just give this away because, you know, the following day, the commissioners of the DWP heard from Douglas and from John Girado of Hollywood Heritage and a letter written by Adrian Scott Fine of the Los Angeles Conservancy, and they were all asking the same thing. Douglas asking most eloquently as the preservationist who had sparked this whole campaign, please, won't you just step back for a moment and consider the possibilities of not seeking immediate demolition of Mr. Sinatra's bungalow in order to expand the footprint of this electrical plant, but listen to the Conservancy that says they want to work with everyone involved and try to find a way to save this building, which has such a lovely sense of history and a connection to the past. And it was kind of extraordinary. There were people there who had gotten the message. They were aware of the petition. They'd seen the letter from the Conservancy.
People from the DWP.
Right. People involved in this project who simply came up to everyone involved and said, you don't have to leave the building right away, do you? Let's go and talk. And they had a talk about the fact that there probably were some things they could talk about. It's a stay of execution. There's a month in which to figure things out.
It's a temporary reprieve. Let's not use the term stay of execution. That's very dramatic. Okay. Okay. I want to stop talking about the bungalow, because that's really good. You told everyone that. It only makes the interview you're about to hear after Steve's that much more pregnant with possibility.
And the only other thing I want to say is that, you know, Douglas was a little, I'm not going to say anxious about it, but, you know, he wanted to be sure he got there on time, and he knew where to park, and he knew what to expect. And I was able to tell him, you know, Nancy Sinatra went up to that building when it was brand new. That's right. Frank's daughter filmed a really terrific scene for her television special, Moving with Nancy, at the new wasn't a landmark at the time, it's become one, DWP headquarters, with a lot of mannequins. And it's the terrific song, This Town, from the movie The Cool Ones. And so I sent him the video on YouTube, because everything's on the YouTube now. And I said, you know, just watch this. And when you go up there, you'll know what it looks like. And you can just remember you're in the footsteps of Nancy, and you're going to stick up for her dad. And, you know, his grandfather used to play with Mr. Sinatra. Right. So there's a nice family connection.
Right. And we get into all of that in the interview. Kim, we're not done with the backstory on this interview. Because Sim Group, who owns... Okay, so this is this preservation challenge appeals to me tremendously, because we've never before gone before the DWP Commission to ask for a reprieve of demolition, which just happened, which is very exciting. It's a new path. It's a new interface, and I like new interfaces. It's a complicated situation. I'm going to repeat this right now. We go into this a little bit in the interview. The land is owned by, the land is going to be passed back to the DWP, that the bungalow and the soundstages sits on. The soundstages and the bungalow, those buildings literally belong to Sim Group, which owns the lot, formerly Goldwyn Studios, originally United Artists, and Doug gets into the transfer of all this. That's really interesting. That's really complicated. What I was hoping you could do, Kim, before we go and introduce Steve and jump into that, I was hoping we could turn back the clock 5 years to Sim Group and the lot.
Sure, there was quite a large preservation presence outside the lot when some of the filmmakers who worked there discovered that there was a plan by Sim, which is just one of, you know, the largest developers in L.A., to knock down a number of the historic structures on the lot in order to build new compounds. And this is, you know, It was very much a time capsule space. And if you've ever watched Sunset Boulevard, you have the notion of what it's like to sort of walk into these two-story bungalows and sit in a writer's room in a tiny little garret and basically brainstorm and remake yourself as whatever it is one becomes in Hollywood. There's a lot of romance. So filmmakers were especially sorry to see it happen. The protests were semi-successful in that some of the older buildings were preserved, but a lot of new development has gone up, and most prominently,
Oprah.
Right, yeah, own Oprah Winfrey Networks has a large glass structure where, you know, ironically enough, it was the Pickford Building.
Yeah.
Mary Pickford, probably the most powerful female entertainment industry figure of her day. Oprah, the same. You know, obviously she could have had a glass high rise anywhere, but she chose to have it on the lot. It's what it is. You know, it's tough. You walk past the Santa Monica Boulevard wall of the building, past the now-shuttered Formosa Cafe, which is an episode in and of itself. It's going to be okay. We hear good things about what's going to happen. And, you know, you just see these lovely little romantic doors that open into the lot. You see the figures, the little faces with the United Artists logo, which I guess are based on Pickford and Fairbanks, and you just get this sense of just so much Hollywood history that somehow has survived in this place, and then you turn your head and there's a glass tower with a giant OWN logo on it, and you wonder, is it possible for any of these old places to stay? Can't we just somewhere hold on to old Hollywood? Sometimes, you know, all it takes is asking that question of the right people, the people who have the ability to say, yeah, you know, it's a lot of years since we've actually let these motion picture people have this land. Maybe we can wait another month and think about that. That's a positive thing in the end.
Yeah, so we're super excited. So as it stands now, there's a meeting the day after this podcast will be released with the DWP, Adrian Scott Fine of the Los Angeles Conservancy, and us guys and gals involved in this, Douglas and others, and so we're obviously going to keep you posted. So I want to jump into introducing Steve and talk about Litten, rhymes with kitten, Litten Savings. Okay, so what I want to do, because of course Steve is equally as articulate as Douglas and incredibly gifted in being the person that wrote the HCM on Litten Savings, is going to gives a great interview. What I want to say is I'm really looking forward to in March of 2018 doing a podcast interview with Douglas and Steve, because these two buildings, I don't want to get into this because I want to keep moving, but I'll get into this in a year. The preservation advocacy narratives for both these buildings are kind of similar. And as people that have done this a lot, Kim, I see we'll wait a year. But in a year, we're going to come back, and we're really going to pull back and start to look at how these things unfold. And there's a lot of similarity, and I'm looking forward to that. I want to say, just before I introduced Steve, he's just an incredible guy. He'll talk about his journey to writing the HCM and getting it passed. You know, Steve has inspired us to do more digging around the architect Kurt Meyer, and it's just it's incredibly rewarding. It's just, Meyer's always fascinated me, and this has just been a great side effect of working with Steve to just, we just found great connections.
Yeah, that tie into one of our favorite things, antiquarian books, and all of that will be revealed perhaps at some point. But yeah. The important thing is that, you know, Kurt Meyer is a person I wish we could have met. I mean, I really admire what he did, because he set aside his architectural practice. And, you know, what are architects if not master egotists? This is not what you expect of them. And yet he walked away from that for a time in order to take a very serious leading role in the Community Redevelopment Agency.
Save the Central Library.
Save the Central Library was instrumental in the development of Angeles Plaza, the incredibly important an incredibly large low-income senior housing development on Bunker Hill, which finally, you know, made good on the old promise that Bunker Hill would be a place where pensioners could live after their homes were seized by eminent domain in the 50s and 60s. He did extraordinary work, and I think it's worth remembering someone who, not a native, a man who came from Switzerland and wanted no part of Los Angeles when he first came here, and yet he grew to love it and grew to serve it in a very profound way.
Okay, Kim, we're going to bring this on home. You're going to bring this on home.
Okay.
LACMA. We were talking about LACMA. Bert Litton, the Amundsen Building. Bart. Thank you, Bart. The Amundsen Building at LACMA originally was going to be the Litton Building. Go.
Oh, baby. It's the hardest thing in the world to actually nail down a donor at your museum. That's all it is, you know? But, yes, I mean, what Bart Litton was doing was promoting the notion of people with money creating cultural pavilions that served everyone, that were meant to elevate Angelenos and give them culture. And that is the reason that we're doing this interview with Steve, because as a five-year-old, he walked into a bank and he looked up and he said, "What is this? I am suddenly elevated. I am a little five-year-old child with a dollar in my pocket who's about to open a bank account, and yet I feel in this space my soul is being spoken to," and it still is.
Right, and what I was hoping we could just end on is we've just really beginning to uncover this tremendous synergy that Litton and Meyer created in a series of projects in the late 60s through the early 70s.
Right, and included at the very heart of it is the loss of the Dodge House. Irving Gill's Dodge House on King's Road, one of the great preservation tragedies of Los Angeles. And, you know, sometimes when you lose, you have to fight harder. I'm glad that we didn't have to go through a loss like that. We've been pretty lucky with our preservation projects, although we see things we care about fall. I can't imagine getting up again after losing Dodge House and doing all the good work that Kurt did. I think Bart maybe had a harder time of it.
We cannot know where others' shoes pinched their toes, darling, happily. We're going to jump into my interview with Steve about Litton Savings. Let's take it away. Steve, I'm here with you. We are in St. Vincent's Court at our favorite deli, Ardo's. And I want you to properly introduce yourself and tell us about the bank.
My name is Stephen Leftman. I grew up in Hollywood, Laurel Canyon. And I am the co-founder of Friends of Litton Savings.
Perfect. Good. Okay. Good. We've built our foundation. So I want you to tell us where this bank, the savings and loan. I want you to tell us where this savings and loan was, where the building still is.
So Litton Savings, it's on the corner of Crescent Heights and Sunset, at the beginning of the Sunset Strip. It was built in 1960. As Litton Savings and Loan by a gentleman whose name is Bart Litton, a bit of a megalomaniac, who thought that if you brought art to the people in his banks, then people would come.
Okay. Good. Stop. What's your first memory?
So my first memory was going in with my parents. They had a savings account at Litton Savings, and going into this incredible modern building and looking up to this coolest zigzag roof. You see the ceiling was just zigzagged away with these big globe chandelier lights, and there was beautiful couches, and it was like a no other bank at five that I've ever been to.
At the age of five.
Yeah, at the age of five. I've been to a lot of banks at the age of five. But they had a big lounge area with these really comfy sofas. It was almost more like a very sophisticated living room.
Good. And so this wasn't just a savings and loan. It was a cultural center. Your mother would routinely drop you and your sister off for movies on Saturday afternoon in the lower level.
That is correct. I have very fond memories. They'd have, the lower level was the Litton Center for the Arts, and they had an exhibit on the beginning of the development of special effects in film. In conjunction with that exhibit, they showed King Kong, the original King Kong, and I have very fond memories of my mother dropping us off and watching King Kong and this amazing film with the gorilla on the side of the Empire State Building.
Good. In addition, we'll come back to the Garden of Allah. We'll come back to that. I want to back up a little bit before we talk about Kurt Meyer. Before we do that, I want you to tell us about Bart's role in a couple museums, because obviously he has a bent for art and the public. I want you, in no particular order, to talk about his role in LACMA and his role in the failed Hollywood Museum.
So, LACMA, he was one of the three big investors who promised to put up the funds for LACMA. He promised $750,000.
A lot of money.
That was a lot of money back then. That was
a lot of money.
Yes. He ended up not coming through with all of that. he came through with about 250,000. But he said that the reason why he didn't come through with it was that he didn't like the direction they were taking. And so he was refusing to give all the money he promised. But his name is still on the wall of the major contributors, so I'm glad to say. In the meantime, he was developing his own art center, which is where I saw the King
right.
Kong, which also showed some groundbreaking shows, one of which was the, I think it was 25 California women artists,
wow.
who very famously, Judy Chicago said, "I don't want to be classified as a Californian or a woman." So she refused to be in it. So his own art center was really the art shows were very much about the California art scene that was really developing at that time in the mid '60s. So at the same time, though, he was on the board of the Hollywood Museum,
yeah.
and he came out saying that nobody here on this board knows what the hell they're doing, and he really thinks this is a bad idea. And they should really stop and take a time out and figure out what the hell they want to do. At the same time, he was buying all of these collections of historic cameras and other film artifacts for his own. And when I say he was buying, it really wasn't him. It was the bank.
Right.
It was the savings and loan. So he was buying all these artifacts because he also had these exhibits at Litton Center about really amazing exhibits. And that was more of what he wanted the Hollywood Museum to be. So one might think that maybe he didn't have enough power at the Hollywood Museum and he thought it best to have only one of these Hollywood museums and it should be his own.
He was correct because the Hollywood Museum never came to be, but that's another podcast for another time. So I think we've established that Bart was not just a financier, but he really had a very strong inclination to the arts and culture. So this is obviously going to manifest itself in his choice of architect.
That is true. So it is. And at the time, there was a great movement of California modern architecture that...
And give us a year on this.
So this actually... I'll give you a very brief history of Litton Savings. He took over this tiny little savings and loan, Canoga Park Savings and Loan. They had capitalization of $25,000. Tiny. And that wasn't even much money then. And he built it up to be the fifth largest savings and loans in the United States. It was capitalized at its height, I think it was $750 million. And during that time, he came up with ideas of giving away free stuff like toasters and stuff. But he also felt that people were seeing the world in a different way, and that if you had this sophisticated modern art, that people would come and that would bring people in, and he could have shows of it. And he started working with an architect, Kurt Meyer, who was born in Switzerland, came to the U.S. in 1948. And together they built a total of six buildings, six savings and loans. And they all had little parks that had sculpture gardens in them. And they had art exhibits in the savings and loans. And they all had room for that. It wasn't just for banking. They didn't utilize every square foot for the banking services. They also had room for art and stuff.
And Kurt Meyer would go on to be the head commissioner. We're gonna wait for the siren.
Okay. President.
Yeah. Well, Kurt Meyer. Kurt Meyer would go on to become the president of the commission of the CRA of Los Angeles. This private citizen board that oversaw the CRA, and he was crucial in shaping the remodel of Central Library.
He was
crucial, and we're going to get to that later. All right, so we've got this really important Swiss-born architect working with this gifted, perhaps megalomaniacal, but gifted entrepreneur, and they come together and they build this amazing art center and savings and loan on the site of what was the Garden of Allah.
That's correct.
And so let's jump to the present day. Okay?
Okay. So he was a colorful figure. Let's put it that way.
Kim, will you please remember that for the guidebook? Colorful. I'll include that in the notes. Colorful.
He was a colorful figure. A gentleman who could not be seen without a cigar in his hand. So the present day, you mean the building where it is now?
Yeah.
So about 3 years ago, the site where the bank still stands was bought by a development company who wants to build a very big development there. And among the things they want to do is tear down the building. So for the past almost year now, three quarters of a year, we have been working to first get the building declared a historic cultural landmark of the city of Los Angeles.
Which you just did.
We just did a few months ago. Now there are three groups suing the city, saying that they didn't properly consider this when the city actually gave permission to tear down the building. And amongst all the groups who are suing, they all agree that one of the things the city did wrong in approving this project was not properly giving direction to about the building and incorporating this building into the project.
Right, so in other words, a good EIR, as opposed to most of the ones that are written for contentious structures, a good EIR gives a couple options, the least impactful of which incorporates identified historic structures into this new construction.
That's correct. And the EIR actually had two alternatives that included the building on the site. But the developer chose to ignore that, even though that the project that was approved has a similar size building at that intersection, right where that building is. So there's really no reason at all that the building can't be incorporated into this project.
Okay. It's okay. It's cool. I want to get to the landmarking and the demolition, and basically the same thing. So I want to back up for a second because this is kind of interesting what's happened. The building was declared a landmark, an HCM, by full council, and as it went through planning and land use management, they split the vote between whether... This is interesting.
Okay, I'll give you a little detail. So along the way of getting this approved...
Approval for the HCM.
For the Historic Cultural Landmark, the planning department maybe, let's say, delayed a couple times the HCM. Well, they sped the approval for the project, and which included the tearing down of the Litton Savings Building. They sped that along, so that where at one point they were both on the same track. Actually, the HCM should have been on a track slightly ahead of the approval of the entire project. By the time it got to the City Planning and Land Use Committee, they delayed the HCM, literally at the same meeting. They were both on the agenda at the same meeting, at the Planning and Land Use, and they delayed the HCM for 1 month. So they approved the tearing down of the building, and then a month later, they said, well, the building is a landmark.
So what does that mean?
It was maybe not the most prudent way for a city's planning department to work. One might think that it gave the impression that maybe the city was working with the developer.
Do you want to talk about the architect attached to the current project just for a moment?
He's a very well-regarded architect. His name is Frank Gehry.
That's enough. Okay, good.
And he actually recently admitted that this is a very nice building, but maybe not a great building, the one we want to save. But he doesn't seem to want to incorporate it into the project.
What's next?
So currently the three lawsuits are going on, and we're hopeful that a judge during these lawsuits will see that the city did not act properly in dismissing the alternatives that included saving the building, and the developer will try to incorporate the building into the development. It could be a great development, and great city developments include preservation of buildings, of great buildings. So,
good. I want you to talk about the significance of this building in design. Maybe just talk about the roof, how it was built in place, just a little bit more, because this is a really important mid-century modern building. Kurt Myers is a visionary, so let's just end on focusing on some of the salient features that are, I guess, almost imminently going to be demolished.
Yeah. So, well, hopefully it's not imminently, I hope, but so Kurt Meyer, this was Kurt Meyer's first major commission. He had only done one building from the ground up before on his own, with his own firm, and that was a little school in Death Valley, a high school in Death Valley, which won awards. But some reason he met Bart Litton, and Bart saw something in him. He actually, his first work with Bart was when Bart changed the name of Canoga Park Savings and Loan to Litton Savings and Loan. He hired Kurt to remodel the storefront savings and loan in Canoga Park. So this was really his second project with Bart.
Tell us about the roof.
And so the roof, so he was designing this, it's considered what's called a new formalist bank building, which sort of is a modernization of a traditional, pillared, very substantial bank building. And he had a very tight deadline on it. Basically, it was about a year, which he couldn't see how he could get the roof done in time to make this deadline. So he came up with, devised this system of casting these cement roof panels in place at the lot, and while they were building the building, and then over a weekend they were able to place them on top of the building and have the roof done, and they were able to make the July 1st, I believe it was, opening in 1960. Whereas if they had to construct it separately, it would be no way they could make this deadline. So that was the impetus of coming up with this idea. At the time, these panels were the largest concrete panels lifted in this manner. So it was a really big deal. And the way it works up, it works. There's no false ceiling below it. So you're looking from inside on the banking floor. You look up two stories where it's all open to the ceiling. And you see this magnificent zigzag roof.
I love it. Tell us your favorite thing about this building to sign off. What's the one, when people drive by or walk by, what's the one thing you want them to think about?
There's so many. It's hard to say, but I love looking in and seeing the stained glass screen, which is part of it. It's still lit. Unfortunately, some of the light bulbs are out, and they haven't been good at replacing them, but it's still lit. And you go and stand in the parking lot next to the McDonald's. This wasn't there. That used to be a beautiful little park. You stand in there, and you can look and see the glow of the stained glass. And to me, that just brings me back to the 60s, and I could just imagine the Sunset Strip. And that is an integral, the screen is an integral artwork to the building. It was designed with the building. It was Kurt Meyer worked with the artist of the screen and worked with the designer of the interior. The fabrics were made all for the building. And really, it's just, it's this amazing structure that combines Googie architecture. It brings your eye in as you drive down the Sunset Strip. That in a way that a more formal building would never do, yet it retains its dignity in a very formal way.
Okay, Steve, thank you so much. That's fantastic.
It's a pleasure.
My name is Elaine, and I'm here in Amy's Castle in Lake Elsinore. And you're listening to You Can't Eat the Sunshine.
Doug, I'm here with you. We are at the lot, and I need you to do two things. First, I need you to properly introduce yourself, and secondly, I need you to tell us exactly where we are, what the lot is, and thirdly, what we're specifically standing in front of.
My name is Doug Quill. I'm sorry, what were the questions again?
Who are you?
My name is Doug Quill. We are currently standing in front of the Frank Sinatra bungalow, which is scheduled to be demolished within the next couple of weeks, along with several historic sound mixing studios. I've started a petition to save these buildings in hopes to protect some of the major contributions to the golden age of Hollywood.
Perfect. And the lot, as it is called now, is formerly the United Artists Studio. Correct?
Correct. Formerly United Artists, was also Samuel Goldwyn, was also the Mary Pickford Fairbanks Studio. So there's been a lot of history, and it's transitioned into some pretty reputable people over the years.
Yeah, and for huge esoteric fans, you will, of course, be happy to hear that Harold Nebensall, producer of M, 1951, which we showed at the Angels Flight screening fundraiser a couple years ago. He had his offices here in the 1950s, so this was a very important place for Harold.
Yeah. I mean, if you kind of look at the history of just the whole complex, Steven Spielberg and Francis Ford Coppola, George Lucas, they occupied a portion of one of the buildings many years ago. That's where, Harrison Ford and the famous story of him getting picked up as a carpenter when he was designing a door, all that took place here. Obviously Fairbanks, Mary Pickford, Charlie Chaplin was one of the founders of the lot. Some of the buildings that are scheduled to be destroyed were the mixing studios were Star Wars, The Wizard of Oz, The Godfather, Raging Bull, The Apartment, West Side Story. I mean, the list goes on and on.
And this giant four-story, really gross glass and steel concrete building we're leaning against used to be
That was the Mary Pickford building. And I came in post-demolition, so since I've been here for a little bit over a year now. But I know from my understanding when that building went down, that was a very sad day. Yeah. There was a lot of protests. I think there were actually several other buildings that were supposed to be demolished, but through preservation groups, I think they were able to, you know, protect those buildings. But unfortunately, you know, the Pickford building went down. A replacement went up. You know, I can understand the value of being able to have the building that we're standing up against over the otherwise antiquated Pickford building. But if you're
I'm just going to interrupt you, which I will never do again on this interview.
Sure.
I'm just going to interrupt you because I want to get to the bungalows. And we all know that we're talking about Hollywood. We sell dreams here. I'm not interested in really ugly glass and cinder block buildings. I'm interested in dreams and memory and stories. Well, so,
no, hey, I'm from the East Coast with a lot of history. Our house that I grew up in is predates the signing of the Constitution, so I'm right there with you.
Good. So let's jump into this. You have a direct connection to Frank Sinatra, your family. So let's just start with that.
Sure. So, you know, I grew up with older parents. I grew up listening to a lot of, you know, music from the 20s and the 40s or, you know, the 30s. And, you know, whether it be Annette Henshaw or the Ink Spots or Frank Sinatra. And my grandfather played. My grandfather was a trumpet player for Sinatra when he played at casinos in Atlantic City. You know, he always described him as a very loyal, honorable guy and obviously very talented. And, you know, aside from being a fan of his music, I have a personal tie on that end as well.
Okay, so we are good. So I think we're ready to go. We are on the lot. We can just see Formosa just behind me. Yep. We're just south of Santa Monica. We're in front of this really quaint bungalow, and it's got the caution tape is up. It's right next to the DWP transformers. So tell us about this building, which goes by the name Sinatra Bungalow, and just let's just start to talk about it.
Sure. So Sinatra for a period of time when he was recording the Sinatra. The concert Sinatra, which was in one of the stages that are scheduled to be demolished. It was said that Sinatra spent, you know, 3 to 6 weeks in this bungalow, and this was his sort of getaway spot when he was in between takes or, taking a beat. So, you know, there's a lot of history to the bungalow. It's a very quaint, charming, Spanish style, bungalow. I've been inside it myself. You know, there's a lot of history. There's a lot of charm to it.
Really nice red tile roof and real original wood windows.
Yeah. There's pretty charming terracotta tiles, and you know, there's a nice fireplace inside and a nice little kitchen. And
is it Batchelder tile? Do you know who the tile maker on the fireplace is?
I couldn't confirm the maker of or the model of the fireplace, but there's a lot of natural wood in there, which I happen to be a personal fan of.
Fantastic. Okay, so looks like the doomsday clock is pretty close to midnight here. We'll say 10 minutes to 12. I don't know. Maybe that's a bit of... The caution tape is up. What is happening here?
So, effectively, as of... what month is this? Are we in April?
April 3.
So, basically, what's going on here, to break this down, is when Pickford and Fairbanks were divorced back in the 50s, the land was divided in two. And what... The half that was given to, or that was, you know, allotted to Mary Pickford, she donated her portion to the city of Los Angeles, and Fairbanks' portion was in the city of West Hollywood. So there was a divide of cities. Now, this created a big problem because, Mary Pickford, who allegedly donated her portion to be turned into a nice park, is now... occupied by the DWP, and as you can see, is more or less an industrial wasteland. Now, the Sinatra bungalow, as well as the three mixing studios, those fell on the property of the city of Los Angeles. So the lot and former owners have effectively been renting these bungalows, which are on the LADWP's land since the 50s, and effectively as of March 31st,
3 days ago.
3 days ago, they decided that they're not going to renew the lease, that they're going to reclaim the land, knock down the fence, knock down the buildings, and, you know, expand the power line footprint.
Okay, great. Good. Good summary. So, tell us what you have done so far.
Oh, boy.
You have a petition. Let's start with obvious things.
Sure.
Petition. Go.
Sure, yeah. So, you know, it started as kind of an initial old-school paper signed petition. You know, I began going around the companies at the lot just to see if they were aware of it and if they'd like to support the petition. And, you know, most people didn't know about it. So, you know, I garnered a lot of support, including Funny or Die and Gary Sanchez Productions, from the companies that are on the lot. And then we evolved to change.org, which is an online petition. We began that. We got picked up a little press by the WehoVille paper. I've been in touch with various preservation groups, including the LA Conservancy, who Adrian Scott Fine from that group has expressed tremendous support. Obviously, I've been in touch with Hollywood Heritage, the state California Preservation Society, and you know, a lot of other people.
Good. And so it is Monday, April 3rd. What is happening tomorrow, Tuesday, April 4th?
So tomorrow on the 4th at 10 a.m., there is the LADWP commissioners meeting. They meet apparently twice a month, and tomorrow is really our final go to try and...
No, never say final.
Final.
Never say final. But I'm going to interrupt. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Never final, but this is... We're getting close to the wire here.
We're getting close. That's fair enough. Let's put it this way. Tomorrow's going to be a big day. It's going to be a very, very big day, and I feel great about it. We all feel very great about it. We have a lot of support going into it. So, you know, tomorrow's going to be important, and I think we're going to have a very successful meeting.
All right, perfect. Let's talk about paths to preservation. Why don't you just, you know, I know that the Conservancy has been aware of this issue for several years. Give us some possible paths for saving this bungalow, because obviously it cannot stay right where it is, right here, because that's just never been an option.
I mean, you know, as much as I would like to say keep everything how it is and find another place to build your power lines, you know, I don't know the logistics that are behind that. And, you know, technically the LADWP owns the land. So if we were to exclude that as a possibility, though,
we'll keep it on the table. But
keep it on the table. One possibility is you know, take the land surrounding the buildings, but don't touch the buildings. I think that would be a best case scenario to shoot for. There's you know, definitely you know, I'd say the structures themselves occupy, just a guesstimation, but about half of the land that they are going to be taking. So, you know, I think that could be a happy medium. But if that's not an option and the buildings are scheduled to be demolished, then, you know, the bungalow is something that could be relocated. You know, and again, being from the East Coast, I've seen them move a lot bigger houses, and this one that would be very, very simple. You know, how that would happen is beyond me. I think we'd have to get some bigger players with some interest.
Well, the owners of the lot, Sim Group, would have to step up to the plate. And so that's something that the Conservancy is looking into. And also, I imagine that people... So we're in a motion picture studio lot. Let's step back.
Correct.
Let's interrupt this narrative of the bungalow. Let's go back in time. Let's go back to 1939. Okay? This is United Artists. It's become Metro Gold. It's become Samuel Goldman. Mm-hmm. It's a studio. you know, there are little production companies that make pictures here. Mm-hmm. The studio system is starting to wind down. It will wind down over the next 20 years. Give us a snapshot today of what life is like here. All these little production companies and a couple really big production companies and how this lot functions today. Because I think everyone in their mind's eye understands what a motion picture lot before World War II was like, right? With just this unified production and a sort of a central head of production that steers everything.
Sure. You know, and I think to see where it is today, you know, you might have to trace back to the times of what started it. And, you know, from my understanding, this lot was originally formed, from my understanding and what I've been told, sort of by some rebels that wanted to, you know, make some films and make some movies outside of the mainstream Hollywood and break the mold and try doing something different. So I think unlike a lot of other studio lots, this was really formed by some rebels guys who wanted to change the system and shake things up a little bit. So I think that to me is admirable in and of itself. And, you know, one of the things that really sparked my interest, other than seeing the buildings being completely stripped out of all the equipment, but was looking at the photos from when this place was a fully functional lot, when they had the back lot before it became occupied by the DWP. I mean, it was really a magnificent place. When I look at these photos and I think, my God, how did they screw this up? You know, how did they destroy so much history? But, you know, even still, if it could be preserved as it is right now, that would be a beautiful thing because it's a magnificent community. I mean, it's full of really talented people and really passionate people of all different sizes. I mean, you have Oprah Winfrey Network and Funny or Die, and then you also have, you know, smaller production companies, and you know, there's a sense of community here, and a lot of people know each other. Everyone's very friendly. The staff are all very friendly. Everyone works very hard. So it has become a second home away from home, away from home. Originally East Coast. But it's one of the main factors that keep me pitching concepts and pitching ideas in LA today is this studio lot.
Fantastic. So let's just wrap this up. Let's just go back to the notion of selling dreams and imagination. This is a bungalow where Frank Sinatra hung out. Can't touch that.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you said it better than I could have. And, you know, simply put, I mean, these studios and this bungalow were some of the greatest, most talented musicians and actors and you know, creatives have worked in the history of Hollywood. And people travel from all over the world to come and make it in Hollywood. So when you get here and all you see are cement structures and glass buildings, I mean, it's not quite the place that people thought it, you know, that they anticipated. So, you know, when you get glimpses of history like the bungalow and like these studios or the lot for that matter, it's very inspiring. You know, I'm inspired every day to get up and come to work. Whether I know what I'm going to do or whether I'm going to, you know, sit and stare at the wall for 5 hours and figure out my next move. You know, I mean, it's part of the grind of working freelance. But, you know, I get on the phone, I make calls, I go and I pace around the parking lot, staring at the bungalow, thinking, you know, one day I'll be where I want. And I hope that these buildings don't go down.
Perfect. Okay. Let's see. This is not going to be published till after the hearing. We're going to publish it in a week. So we'll before I introduce this interview in the podcast, you will have gotten an update, if any, and we'll see. Is there anything else? So you have a petition. We'll put the petition on the webpage for this episode, and people can follow the link and go sign the petition. Is there anything else you want people to know about this, about your campaign to save the Frank Sinatra bungalow?
You know, I sometimes look back to Europe, right? And the reason that people keep, you know, I want to travel to Europe, I want to go to Italy, I want to go to Germany or France, or, you know, and you go there, and the architecture is magnificent. And I think one of the reasons that keeps people wanting to travel to Europe is the history. And I think that goes for Hollywood, too. You know, people want to come to Hollywood because of the history and because they want to follow their dreams. And I guess my final closing statement would be, if you level this place and you destroy everything that got us to where we are today, I think it's going to change Hollywood in a way that I couldn't possibly imagine. But I don't think it'd be for the better. I think these buildings must be protected. There's a lot of history to it. There's a tremendous amount of backstory, and it's time that we wake up and stop tearing apart the foundation that got us to where we are today.
Doug, that was fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
My name's Dan Fonte, and we are in Los Angeles 90066, also known as Mar Vista, California. And you're listening to You Can't Eat the Sunshine.
And we're done. I'd like to thank everyone for listening to our latest podcast, You Can't Eat the Sunshine, for the month of April 2017. Our guests this week were Steve Luftman. He's a preservationist. He talked about his efforts to save the Kurt Meyer Litton Savings, a mid-century landmark that is currently threatened with demolition. Second interview today, filmmaker Douglas Quill. We are learning about his last-ditch campaign to preserve Frank Sinatra's motion picture bungalow on the old Goldwyn Studios lot in Hollywood. And these are great buildings. These are great campaigns. So we like to hear from you. And I say this as we sort of start the slow fade. Feedback loop. Kim, please, what is the feedback loop?
Well, you can always send us an email at youcanteatthesunshine@gmail.com or through the contact link at www.esoteric.com. You can join us on an esoteric bus adventure. We're always happy to see people on the bus, or you can come to one of the lava events like the Sunday Salons or the Forensic Science Seminars at Cal State LA. And if you're so inclined and you're listening on iTunes, or you're an iTunes user, you can give us a review over there and let people know that you're listening, because it does help people find the podcast. We like to hear from you, so don't be a stranger.
Okay, great. So, Kim, we are in the home stretch here. You were going to look ahead to some tours. Okay, go.
Oh, there's so much fun stuff going on. And we're heading into a season of Saturday tours and various themes, and we'd love to see you on the bus. We have The Real Black Dahlia on April 15th, Tax Day, a tour that looks into not so much who killed Bess Short, the victim in the 1947 mutilation murder that remains unsolved, but who she was and why you should care about her. We follow in her footsteps and look at the newspapers, the police investigation, and ultimately the district attorney's investigation and FBI investigation that followed. It is a time travel trip. On Saturday, April 22nd, we'll be doing our Charles Bukowski's Los Angeles tour, and that would be a great introduction to the Lava Sunday Salon that'll be coming up in May as well, Bukowski-themed. So that's a tour of downtown in Hollywood. It's about finding the voice within yourself that is great, and even at the age of 50, you can become a really influential author. I believe he is still the most shoplifted author in America, and that's high praise indeed. On the 29th of April, it's Raymond Chandler's Los Angeles tour, a downtown and Hollywood locations, from Chandler's misspent youth as an oil company executive to his misspent middle years as a Hollywood screenwriter. It's a kind of sad and loving and sweet story with some terrific time capsule interiors. In May the 6th, it's Blood and Dumplings, a crime bus tour of the San Gabriel Valley, which includes some really daffy cases and characters, a dumpling picnic in a garden of concrete sea monsters, and the story of Vilma, the sassy, very, very sassy, one would say incredibly sassy, Clifton's Cafeteria camera girl who kept a diary of her El Monte dates, and those stories will be shared by her daughters, and it's always a lot of fun to bring her to life on that tour. May the 13th, it's Hollywood with an exclamation point, one of our newest crime bus tours. It is my old stomping ground, so it's weird tales of old Hollywood and a little bit of how I got to be exactly as twisted as I am while growing up there. Weird West Adams is on Saturday, May the 20th, and it is a tour about some of the most lovely neighborhoods that the freeway almost but didn't destroy. We'll be going to Rosedale Cemetery and walking around there. We'll be talking about Marvin Gaye. And hopefully we'll have a lot of locals on the bus, because this month we are the cover story in the West Adams Heritage Association's newsletter, with some lovely photos of us wandering around Alvarado Terrace. Then we head into a special event tour at the start of June. Once a year, we do a tour about Tom Waits in Los Angeles, in downtown and Hollywood, and a little bit of West Hollywood and Echo Park. My longtime compatriot, David Smay, who I did some music anthologies with, comes down from San Francisco to lead this tour, which is based on his book about Swordfish Trombones, the album from the 33 and a third series. And it is a very special, sweet day out. And if you love Tom Waits and want to see some places where he is still sort of palpably felt, and do that in the company of people who also dig the music, join us, do. It's only once a year. June the 10th, it's a downtown double feature of true crime and social history called Hotel Horrors and Main Street Vice. Beautiful interiors, terrible stories, Skid Row tales that will break your heart. The Skid Row Slasher is a murder case that I just never cease to be fascinated by, and we'll even go into the Bonaventure and talk about a futuristic murder that really is going to change the way you think about that building. Then, another special event. This is for our 10th anniversary on the 17th of June. It's Desert Visionaries, Llano del Rio, Antelope Valley Indian Museum, and the Aldous Huxley Pear Blossom Ranch. And it is going to be quite an excursion, an all-day trip out into, is that the high desert?
Yeah,
it's the high desert, and it is very, very high indeed. People went out there and had some of the greatest ideas you've ever seen, and it's incredible to see how some of these spaces have survived and changed over the years. Well, you took that away. Eastside Babylon is on June the 24th. No, I remember. That's a crime bus tour, probably my most unhinged. And then finally, on July the 8th, we have Pasadena Confidential, and of course, a Pasadena crime tour is going to be about rocket science, black magic, inappropriate pets of millionaires, presidential assassins, you know, our kind of people. We'd love to see you on the bus.
Thank you, Kim. Thank you. So, and I want to thank everyone for listening. I want to encourage you to continue to listen and to stay tuned, and I want to remind you,
you can't eat the sunshine.
You can't eat the sunshine, but you can make a beeline for the best of the coastline. La, 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 la. Skid Row, Solano Canyon, the Doria, and Pico Union, the long-lost neighborhood called Hermina between South